I will keep preaching. Sotir Tsechi was a devout Orthodox who lived in Tehran. As a child, he had tuberculosis of the bone and suffered excruciating pain in his legs. When he was 17 years old, he became so depressed that he decided to kill himself by jumping in front of a train. Shortly before he was about to do so, Leonida Pope, a relative, visited him. Not knowing what Sotir was planning, Leonida told him that Jesus cured the sick and that the earth would be a paradise. He also gave Sotir a copy of the Greek scriptures, which Sotir immediately began to read. "It was like water poured into me," said Sotir. "I had found the truth." Within a few days, and without further contact with Leonida, Sotir reasoned, "The Bible says that Jesus preached. The apostles and disciples all preached. Obviously, that is what I must do." So, Sotir set out to preach. With the Greek scriptures in one hand and his crutch in the other, he courageously went from door to door. During those years, the Sigurimi, or Directorate of State Security, was responsible for protecting the nation's security. Ever alert to any apparent threat to communism, they could hardly fail to notice Sotir's bold preaching. They arrested him, held him for hours, beat him, and ordered him not to preach. When Sotir was released, he contacted Leonida, who took him to Spiro Karayani, a doctor who had learned the truth some years earlier. Besides medical attention, Spiro helped Sotir get a better understanding of the truth. "If you are arrested again," Spiro advised Sotir, "before you sign anything, count every word and every line. Draw a line after their words. Don't leave a space. Read everything carefully. Be sure that what you sign is what you said." Just 2 days later, the police caught Sotir preaching again. At the police station, the officers ordered him to sign a statement. As he was about to sign, he remembered Spiro's advice. Despite pressure from the police to sign quickly, Sotir took the time to read every word. "I am sorry," he said. "I cannot sign this. I did not say these words. If I signed this document, it would be a lie, and I cannot lie." The police responded by making a whip out of a rope, which they used to beat Sotir for several hours. When he still would not cooperate, they forced him to hold two wires and repeatedly gave him excruciating electric shocks. "When I could hardly stand the pain," Sotir later recalled, "I prayed with tears. Suddenly, the door swung open. There stood the chief officer. He glanced over and quickly turned his head away. 'Stop,' he ordered. 'You're not supposed to do that.'" They were all fully aware that torture was against the law. The police stopped the torture, but they did not stop putting pressure on Sotir to sign the document. Still, he refused. "You win," they eventually said. Reluctantly, they wrote down the statement that Sotir himself had made, in which he gave a fine witness. They handed him the document. Despite hours of beatings and shock treatment, Sotir read every word carefully. When a sentence ended halfway across the page, he drew a line at the end of the sentence. "Where in the world did you learn that?" asked the amazed officers. "Jehovah taught me not to sign what I did not say," replied Sotir. "Okay, so who gave you this?" asked an officer, handing Sotir a piece of bread and a piece of cheese. By then it was 9 p.m., and Sotir was ravenous, not having eaten all day. "Was it Jehovah?" "No, we did." "Jehovah has many ways of providing," Sotir replied. "He just softened your hearts." "We'll let you go," said the frustrated officers, "but if you preach again, you know what will happen." "Then do not let me go, because I will keep preaching." "You'd better not tell anyone what happened here," commanded the officer. "If they ask," responded Sotir, "I cannot lie." "Just get out of here," barked the police. Sotir was one of many who were tortured that way. It was only after this faith-testing incident that Sotir was baptized. For years, mail was censored and only sketchy reports trickled out of Albania. As travel and meeting attendance became increasingly risky, brothers around the country started to lose contact with one another. With no central organization, it was difficult to get a clear picture of what was happening. Nevertheless, the number of those who embraced the truth continued to grow. In 1940, there were 50 brothers and sisters in Albania, and in 1949, there were 71. Theocratic increase amid political tension. The 1950s saw even tighter controls enforced on all aspects of life. Political tensions between Albania and Greece were mounting. Diplomatic relations with England and the United States were non-existent. Even links with the Soviet Union were strained. Albania was withdrawing into an isolationist shell, closed to the outside world, with all communications closely monitored. Nevertheless, two of the brothers had limited success sending letters and postcards to the brothers in Switzerland. The Swiss brothers replied in French or Italian, using coded language. By means of these postcards, the Albanian brothers learned about the Nuremberg Convention that had been held in 1955. News of the freedom enjoyed by the German brothers after the end of Hitler's regime encouraged the Albanian brothers to remain steadfast in the faith. By 1957, Albania was reporting 75 publishers. Although exact figures were not available, the memorial was commemorated by a goodly number, reported the 1958 yearbook, and the Albanian brothers are still preaching. The 1959 yearbook reported, "These faithful witnesses of Jehovah are continuing to do what they can. They have spoken the truth plainly to others and have even tried to publish some things. They are grateful for the meat in due season that has reached them on occasions, but evidently the communistic rulers have closed down all communications from the outside world." The report concluded, "While the rulers of the land may separate the brothers in Albania from the rest of the New World Society, they cannot cut off the operation of God's Holy Spirit upon them." Struggles continue. At that time, everyone was expected to carry a military identity card. Those who refused would lose their job or be imprisoned. As a result, Nasho Dori and Yanni Comino again spent some months in prison. Although a few feared losing their jobs and compromised, a solid core of loyal brothers observed the memorial in 1959, and many brothers and sisters were still preaching fearlessly. In 1959, the Ministry of Justice was dissolved, and lawyers were no longer allowed to practice. The Communist Party itself made and applied all laws. Those who did not vote in elections were considered to be the enemy. Fear and suspicion abounded. The Albanian brothers sent out messages indicating how trying things were, but expressing their determination to remain loyal. In the meantime, the world headquarters in Brooklyn kept trying to make contact with the brothers in Albania. John Marks, who was born in southern Albania but was living in the United States, was asked to try to obtain a visa for Albania. A year and a half later, John succeeded in getting a visa to enter Albania, although his wife Helen did not. John arrived at Durrës in February 1961 and traveled to Tiran. There he met his sister, Melpo, who had shown interest in the truth. She helped John make contact with the brothers the very next day. John talked with the brothers at length and gave them some literature that he had concealed in a secret compartment of his suitcase. The brothers were thrilled. They had not had a visit from brothers outside of Albania in over 24 years. John calculated that there were 60 brothers in 5 towns and a few others in smaller villages. In Tiran, the brothers were trying to meet secretly once a week on Sundays to review the publications they had kept hidden since 1938. With so little contact with the organization for so long, the Albanian brothers had to be brought up to date on organizational matters and current truths. For example, both brothers and sisters were conducting meetings, and sisters even offered prayers. John later wrote, "The brothers were rather skeptical and concerned about how the sisters would accept the adjusted arrangements, So they asked me to explain them to the sisters privately, which I did. I was glad to see that they accepted them. Despite their poverty, these faithful servants zealously supported the kingdom work. For instance, John took note of two elderly brothers from Girocaster who had saved from their very little money and had accumulated a certain amount for donations to the society. Each one had saved over $100 in gold coins. The brothers in Tehran appreciated receiving the booklet Preaching and Teaching in Peace and Unity, which provided direction on how the congregations were to function, even under ban. Then, in March, John held the memorial in Tehran at the home of Leonida Pope, with 37 present. Right after the talk, John took a boat back to Greece. After the brothers at headquarters considered John's report on his visit to Albania, they assigned Leonida Pope, Sotir Papa, and Luci Jeka to care for the Tehran congregation and the work in Albania. Spiro Vruho was appointed as a circuit overseer. He was to visit congregations and meet with the brothers every evening, giving talks and discussing the publications. The organization was making every effort to help the brothers in Albania grow spiritually stronger and be brought up to date. Needless to say, with mail being carefully censored, the organization could not send a formal letter providing this direction. Instead, John conveyed the information to the brothers in Albania little by little, using a code that referred to pages in the publications. Soon, reports came back showing that the brothers had got the point precisely. The three brothers in Tehran were functioning as a country committee, and Spiro was visiting congregations regularly. The Albanian brothers had to find novel ways of sending field service reports to headquarters. One way was on postcards sent to specific brothers abroad. Then, using a fine-tipped pen, the reports were written in code under the stamp. For example, they would write the page number in the preaching and teaching booklet where the subject publishers was considered. Next to that, they would write the number of publishers who reported for the month. For many years, the brothers abroad used similar methods to communicate with the brothers in Albania. A good start, then a blow. Though the country committee was working hard to promote pure worship, trouble was soon to come. In 1963, Melpo Marx wrote her brother John that two of the three brothers who made up the country committee, Leonida Pope and Luci Jeka, were away from their families and that meetings were not being held. Later came word that Spiro Vruho was in the hospital and that Leonida Pope and Luci Jeka were sick, referring to Acts 8, 1 and 3, where Saul of Tarsus sent Christians to prison. What was happening? Leonida Pope, Luci Jeka, and Sotir Tsechi worked in a factory where members of the Communist Party held talks for all the workers, promoting communist ideals. One day, during a talk about evolution, Leonida and Luci stood up and said, "No, man did not come from monkeys." The next day, both were taken away from their families and sent to work as exiles in distant cities, a punishment Albanians called internim, or internment. Luci was sent to the mountains of Gramsh. Because they considered Leonida to be in charge, he was sent to the rugged, cold mountains of Burel. It would be 7 years before he returned to his home in Tehran. By August 1964, meetings had essentially stopped. The little information that trickled out indicated that the brothers were under strict surveillance by the Sigurimi. One message beneath a stamp read, "Pray to the Lord for us. Seizure of literature house to house. They do not allow us to study. Three persons in internim." At first, it was thought that brothers Pope and Jeka had been released, since they were the only ones who knew about writing under stamps. However, it later turned out that Luci's wife Frosina had communicated that message. The brothers who took the lead had been sent away. The vigilant eye of the Sigurimi did not let the others communicate with one another. Nonetheless, the brothers in internim gave a remarkable witness to whomever they met. The people of Gramsh would say, The ungilor, or evangelizers, are here. They don't go into the military, but they build our bridges and fix our generators. These loyal brothers gained a glowing reputation that remained for decades. The following is from pages 151 and 152 of the printed edition.
Jehovah never left us. Frosina Jaka, born 1926, baptized 1946. Profile: she learned the truth as a teenager. Although her parents opposed her and the authorities isolated her, she always felt close to Jehovah and his organization. She died faithful in 2007. Frosina learned the truth from her brothers in the 1940s. Her non-witness parents threw her out of their home because she refused to enter an arranged marriage. A brother, Gole Floko, took her into his family and treated her like a daughter. "Once I was arrested because I refused to vote," Frosina said. "I was alone in a room when about 30 officers surrounded me. One screamed, 'Do you have any idea what we can do to you?' I felt that Jehovah was with me and said, 'You can do nothing that the Sovereign Lord Jehovah will not permit you to do.' They thought I was crazy, so they said, 'Get her out of here.' You see, I was right. Jehovah was with me." In 1957, Frosina married Luchi Jaka, and in time they had 3 children. In the early 1960s, Luchi was made a member of the newly formed country committee, which was to oversee the work in Albania. Soon he was sentenced to 5 years of internim, or internment, in Gramsh, far from Frosina and the children. There, Luchi continued to preach and talk about the organization. People in Gramsh remember him to this day. With Luchi in internim, the Communist Party blacklisted Frosina so she could not officially buy food. Frosina says, "It didn't matter. The few brothers shared what they had. We got by because Jehovah never left us." After Luchi's death, meetings with the brothers were rarer, yet Frosina still preached. She recalls, "John Marks visited us in the 1960s. When I finally met his wife Helen in 1986, it felt as though we had known each other for years. Luchi and I had secretly sent messages to the Marks, and they had passed them on to the brothers in Brooklyn." When the ban was lifted in 1992, Frosina was one of the 9 baptized witnesses left in Albania. She was regular at meetings and was out in the service the very day of her death in 2007. Shortly before she died, Frosina said, "I love Jehovah with all my heart. Compromise was never an option. I knew I had a large family around the world, but now I'm overwhelmed to see how big our theocratic family is in Albania. Jehovah was always with us, and he is still holding us in his loving hands." Returning to the account.
An atheistic state is born. On the political front, Albania severed ties with the Soviet Union and became more closely allied with China. Communist ideology was gaining such momentum that some Albanians even dressed in outfits similar to those worn by Chinese Communist Party chairman Mao Zedong. By 1966, Enver Hoxha abolished military ranks, and in a climate of mistrust, no opposing opinions were tolerated. State-run newspapers began printing articles against religion, calling it a dangerous element. Then, in Durres, a group of students used a bulldozer to destroy a church. In quick succession, in city after city, other religious buildings were destroyed. In 1967, with the government fanning the flames of anti-religious sentiment, Albania became the first completely atheistic country. Whereas other communist states kept religion under control, Albania did not even tolerate it. Some Muslim, Orthodox, and Catholic priests were imprisoned because of their political activities. Numerous priests fared better because they capitulated and simply stopped being religious. A few historic religious buildings were turned into museums. No religious insignia were permitted. No crosses or icons, no mosques or minarets. The word God was used only in a derogatory way. These developments made the situation difficult for the brothers. During the 1960s, some of the brothers fell asleep in death. The remaining scattered publishers still spoke up in defense of the truth as much as they could. But even people who had some interest were too afraid to listen. Love for the truth never grew dim. In 1968, Gole Floco wrote to John and Helen Marx about his failing health. It was illegal to preach, and meetings were banned. But Gole, now in his 80s, described how he regularly spoke to friends and to people he met in the market, the park, or coffee shops. Not long thereafter, Gole died faithful. Like so many others in Albania, nothing could extinguish his irrepressible love for Jehovah and the truth. With advancing age, Spiro Vruho could no longer make circuit visits as he had. Then, early in 1969, he was found dead at the bottom of a well. The Sigurimi reported that he had committed suicide. But was this true? Although Spiro supposedly left a suicide note saying that he was depressed, the note was not in his handwriting. Also, before his death, Spiro was confirmed to be in good spirits. In addition, there were telltale black marks around his neck, indicating some kind of assault. No ropes were found at the well on which he could have hung himself, and there was no water in his lungs. Years later, it came to light that Spiro had been told that if he did not vote, he and his family would be put in prison and their food supplies would be cut off. The brothers in Tehran found out that Spiro was killed the day before elections, then thrown into the well. This was not the last time false reports of suicides were used against Jehovah's Witnesses. A decade of enforced isolation. In 1971, Jehovah's Witnesses around the world rejoiced when more members were added to the governing body in Brooklyn, New York. Great was the anticipation when the arrangement for appointing elders and ministerial servants was announced. It was years, though, before our brothers in Albania heard about these organizational adjustments. When they did, it was because tourists from the United States made brief contact with Lopi Blani, a sister in Tehran. They learned that no meetings were being held, and they were told that there were only 3 active witnesses in the city, though there were actually many more. Costa Dabe had been in Greece since 1966 trying to get a visa permitting him to return to his native Albania. At 76 years of age, he wanted to teach the truth to his children. Unable to get a visa, Costa handed in his U.S. passport at the Albanian border and entered the country, knowing that he might never be able to leave. In 1975, an Albanian couple from the United States visited Albania as tourists. They wrote that the surveillance was tighter than ever and that Jehovah's Witnesses were being closely watched. Foreigners were accompanied everywhere by official tour guides, many of whom were part of the Sigurimi. After the foreigners left, the Sigurimi would focus attention on those who were contacted. Tourists themselves were regarded with suspicion and were unwelcome. People were fearful of foreigners. In November 1976, a letter from Costa Dabe reported that 5 attended the memorial in Vlor. He knew that in Permet and Thiers, 1 witness in each city held the memorial alone. In Tehran, 2 joined at 1 location and 4 at another. So, from what he knew, at least 13 were at the memorial in 1976. Years later, Kula Jidhari remembered how she observed the memorial. In the morning I made bread and took out wine. That evening I closed the curtains and got out the Bible I had hidden behind the toilet. I read in Matthew chapter 26 how Jesus instituted the memorial. I prayed, held up the bread, and then put it down. I read some more from Matthew, prayed again, held up the wine, and then put it down. After that, I sang a song. I was alone physically, but I knew I was united with my brothers all over the world. Kula had little family. Years earlier, Spiro Karayani had adopted her when she was young, and she lived with him and his daughter Penelope in Tehran. He died about 1950. Increasing isolation for Albania. A new era of isolation began in 1978 when Albania cut ties with China. A new constitution aimed to make Albania completely self-sufficient, with strict guidelines governing all aspects of life, including the theater, the ballet, literature, and art. Classical music that was considered seditious was banned. Only authorized writers were permitted to own private typewriters. Anyone caught tuning into television programs from other countries would be interrogated by the Sigurimi. In this climate of severe repression, brothers from Austria, Germany, Sweden, Switzerland, and the United States entered as tourists in an effort to contact the local brothers. The few who were contacted truly appreciated those efforts. Yet, the brothers in general remained isolated from one another, so that few knew if a visitor was coming. In 1985, Albanians mourned the death of the long-term dictator Enver Hoxha. Government and social changes were soon to be made. By the following year, John Marks had died, and his widow Helen, in her mid-60s, decided to visit Albania. "If anything happens to you while you're there," the authorities told her when she picked up her visa, "do not expect help from the outside world." Helen's two-week trip was a landmark for the handful of publishers in Albania. Helen finally met Melpo, John's sister, who had heard about the truth from her brother 25 years earlier. Though still not baptized, Melpo was a key contact for the organization for many years. Helen also met with Leonida Pope and Vasil Joka, who was baptized in 1960. She learned about seven witnesses who were still alive in various parts of the country. She gave the brothers in Albania up-to-date facts about the organization and how the work was moving forward in other communist lands. Helen cautiously preached informally to those she met. She noted, though, that economic problems abounded in Albania. To get a small ration of milk, she said, it was normal to wait in line from 3 o'clock in the morning. Many stores had no supplies. In 1987, the branches in Austria and Greece combined efforts to get other visitors into Albania. In 1988, a couple from Austria, Peter Malobovitz and his wife, traveled in as tourists and gave Melpo a blouse, which she was delighted to receive. She was far more thrilled, though, to find the book Things in Which It Is Impossible for God to Lie hidden inside the blouse. Later that year, another couple contacted Melpo with more literature, but they had to be extremely cautious because the Sigurimi was watching them like hawks. Within the few minutes that the visitors were unaccompanied by their so-called official guides, they could make only brief contact. They learned that Leonida was ill and that many other brothers in Albania had grown old and could not move about freely. The following is from pages 159 and 160 of the printed edition.
From Little Literature to an Abundance. Vasil Joka. Born 1930. Baptized 1960. Profile. He took a firm stand for the truth amid totalitarian rule. Today he serves as an elder in Tehran. I remember seeing the Greek watchtower in my village of Barmash in the 1930s. My father pointed at the magazine and said, "Those people have it right." I did not know what his words meant until years later. I loved reading the Bible, though it became dangerous to have one. At an in-law's funeral, I met a brother from Tehran. I asked about the sign of the last days in Matthew chapter 24. He explained it, and right away I told everyone I could what I was learning. In 1959, I attended a private meeting with the brothers at Leonida Pope's home. I had been reading the book of Revelation and asked about the identity of the wild beast and Babylon the Great. When the brothers explained them to me, I knew this was the truth. I got baptized a year later. I was zealous in preaching, and because of that, I was fired from my job. So I got a rickety old wooden cart and delivered goods in Tehran. Though I had limited contact with the brothers and no literature, I kept preaching. In the early 1960s, before Leonida Pope was sent into Internim, he managed to get a couple of Greek publications that were smuggled into Albania. He translated out loud, and I wrote down what he said in a notebook. Then, at his direction, I made copies and sent them to a few brothers in Berat, Fier, and Vlor. What changes have come about since the 1990s? I am thrilled to see the abundance of literature that Jehovah has given us. From 1992 until today, we have placed over 17 million magazines in Albanian. The new publications are translated into Albanian, and we have the entire New World Translation in our language. When I think of the years without literature, I cannot hold back my tears of joy. Having so little for so long has made us very appreciative. Returning to the account,